Hello, Ange McCormack with you for the Hack Podcast. I'll be filling in for Avni Dias for the next little while. She's off working really hard bringing you Hack's next collaboration with the ABC's Four Corners program. But coming up in the next half hour, you're going to learn about a really common problem that might be lurking in your own home right now that could actually be making you sick. Find out what it is in about 10 minutes' time. Plus, later on, we'll be talking about discrimination against young people in the LGBTQI community. But first, the crisis in the Middle East is getting worse.
Hack.
When I was carrying my small boy, he told me, "Dad, I don't want to die."
On Triple J.
Almost 200 people have been killed, including dozens of children. Tension and deadly violence in Gaza has escalated massively. Entire civilian families have been wiped out, buildings have been flattened, and even offices of media outlets have crumbled after an Israeli airstrike on the weekend. It's prompted major protests all around the world. You might have even seen them in your own city on Saturday. So what should the rest of the world be doing to step up and end the violence? Text me on 0439 75 7555. If you're wondering how it's gotten to this point in the last few weeks, Joe Lauder has this story.
Free, free Palestine!
Free, free Palestine!
Over the weekend, thousands of people turned out to rallies across Australia to show solidarity with people living in the Palestinian territories after a week of violence between Israel and Gaza.
Because to care about Palestine, you don't have to be Palestinian, you don't have to be Muslim, you don't have to be Arab, you just have to...
This conflict has been going on for decades, and it doesn't take much for tensions to spill over into a crisis like this one, which started last week over the forced evictions of Palestinian families in East Jerusalem. Yesterday was the deadliest day so far, with 42 Palestinians killed in the attacks on the Gaza Strip, bringing the Palestinian death toll to 197, including over 50 kids. In this video, a little six-year-old girl was pulled alive from the rubble after being trapped for 7 hours. But her mother and three siblings died in the attack. Eleven Israelis have been killed by the rockets fired from Hamas. That's the Palestinian militant group that controls Gaza. Hamas has fired off thousands of rockets into Israeli towns and cities, although Israel has a defence system that's known as the Iron Dome that shoots down most of these, and some of the rockets have fallen short. Israel hasn't launched as many airstrikes. They also use targeted attacks, but it's in one of the most densely populated parts of the world, making them far deadlier.
We were in the building when the call came to the owner of the building asking him to tell all the residents and our office Al Jazeera and AP to evacuate.
One Israeli airstrike over the weekend targeted and destroyed a tower in Gaza that had the offices of the media organisations Al Jazeera and the Associated Press. In this video, reporters are scrambling to get their equipment and belongings before evacuating after being given 10 minutes to leave. And then they recorded the building being destroyed. A spokesman for the Israeli government has said they were targeting Hamas in the strike.
Hamas was using that building. Its military intelligence had assets in that building that were part of the Hamas war machine. And the minute they turn what is supposed to be a civilian target into a part of their military infrastructure, it becomes a legal target.
Israeli PM Benjamin Netanyahu has addressed his country on TV and said they aren't going to be stopping their airstrikes. He says Israel has a right to defend itself against the attacks.
This past week, millions of Israelis were forced into bomb shelters as missiles rained down on our cities. Several Israelis have been killed. You know, and I know, no country would tolerate this. Israel will not tolerate this. Israel has responded forcefully to these attacks, and we will continue to respond forcefully until the security of our people is reinstated and restored.
The mothers, the daughters, my
The tensions have also spilled over outside the Middle East. In Europe, there's been a wave of threats and attacks against Jewish people in response to the recent fighting. A video was posted online of a convoy of cars with Palestinian flags in London, and someone in them was using a megaphone to shout anti-Semitic abuse into a Jewish neighbourhood.
In a tweet, Prime Minister Boris Johnson said, "There's no place for anti-Semitism in our society. Ahead of Shavuot, I stand with British Jews who should not have to endure this type of shameful racism we've seen today."
There's been a lot of international pressure for the two sides to come to the table and stop the bloodshed. And yesterday, the UN Security Council hosted a video hookup on the crisis. The UN Secretary General called for the violence to end.
"Fighting must stop. I appeal to all parties to heed this call."
But in the end, the Security Council couldn't even agree to a statement about the issue. The United States is a major ally of Israel and has been calling for a de-escalation. But so far, there's been no progress on an actual truce. And it's unclear if America is privately pushing Israel to even agree to a truce. The UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres says the situation is spiralling into an uncontainable crisis, as he described it.
"This latest round of violence only perpetuates the cycles of death, destruction and despair, and pushes farther to the horizon any hopes of coexistence and peace."
You're listening to Hack on Triple J.
Joe Lauder reporting there. Let's dig a little deeper into this conflict. Anthony Lowenstein is an independent journalist. He's living in Sydney, but he was based in East Jerusalem between 2016 and 2020. Anthony, thanks for joining me. The UN is calling for a ceasefire here. The US is calling for de-escalation, but we've heard how messy both of those things are panning out to be. What actually needs to happen to stop the violence? What's going to work?
Well, the fighting obviously has to end. There's no question about that. But what I think is important to remember here is this didn't suddenly start a week ago. I'm not going to give history for the last 70 years, don't worry. But I think what's important to remember here is that this conflict is not simply about Hamas firing rockets and Israel responding. Gaza, which is a Palestinian territory with 2 million people, I've been there a number of times in the last 15 years, is one of the most tightly, densely concentrated places in the world. And people cannot leave. They're literally trapped. So just imagine, if a country, any country, Israel in this case, is bombing you, you can't leave. You can maybe walk outside your house, but you literally can't walk away. You can't go anywhere. You're trapped. It's been under an illegal blockade 15 years now by Israel and Egypt. So you're in this tightly concentrated area and you're being bombed. There are dozens of kids that have been killed. And I think what's important to remember here is this is an occupation. An occupation is not about two equal sides. You know, so much of the media coverage in the West is about war breaks out, there's Israel on one side and Hamas or the Palestinians on the other side. And yes, on one level, that's true, but these are two profoundly unequal sides. One side is the occupier, Israel, and one side is the Palestinians. I think it's really important that people remember that because that's ultimately what's going on here.
Yeah, right. And I mean, US President Joe Biden's been on the phone. He's spoken to both Israel's president and the Palestinian Authority president. But how has Australia responded here?
Look, Australia is generally one of the most pro-Israel countries in the world. And at every UN vote in the last many years, Australia is pretty much almost alone in the world, with the US on one side and a few Pacific islands, Nauru, Micronesia, Palau, and Australia. In this current conflict, the Australian government's been 100% behind Israel, and I might also add so is the Labor Party. This isn't generally a bipartisan issue, and that's depressing in a way because in the public here in Australia and in many Western countries, public opinion, in fact, is shifting a lot, including in the US, where the US really is the key country here. You know, if the US wanted to stop the occupation tomorrow, they could. They fund most of this. And what you've seen in the last few weeks is a really important shift where in the Democratic Party, which, yes, is controlled by Joe Biden, who's very pro-Israel and seems they have no interest in stopping the war, but many prominent Democrats, AOC and others, have come out and said exactly what's happening here. These are war crimes being committed by Israel. This is apartheid being committed by Israel, and this must stop. But this is not just a question of the war stopping today or tomorrow. It's about changing policies, which would, for example, involve stopping US military support or military aid, which is in the billions of dollars every year. Mm. So Australia's role on one level is quite small, but it's actually in the West quite significant.
Yeah, and I mean, this whole conflict, it feels like an endless loop of bloodshed. As you say, it's been going on for decades, and attempts at peacemaking have failed over and over again. Can you unpack some of the other approaches to peacemaking that are being considered and put on the table now?
You know, one of the things that we often hear about by all leaders in Australia, the US, is there should be a two-state solution. Many of your listeners will have heard that expression. That's been said for a couple of decades now. And what that means in theory is an Israeli-Jewish state on one side and a Palestinian state on the other side. But there's now in the last decades about 750,000 Israeli-Jewish settlers living illegally in occupied territory. Now, we use the term settlers, but actually they're colonists. They're there illegally occupying Palestinian land. And increasingly, the thought about this is a one-state solution. I've argued that myself, and I'm Jewish. I'm a Jewish Australian who, unlike many other Jews you may speak to, is very, very critical of what Israel is doing and is not behaving, in my case, in my name at all. A one-state solution essentially means one state. Anyone can live there, Jew, Palestinian, Christian, Muslim, atheist, whatever it may be. Because at the moment, what a lot of listeners should be aware is there's a growing sense in Israel by many Jews, I'd say, and the wider population there of Jewish supremacy. I call it sort of the Jewish Taliban. Obviously, I'm talking about Jews, not Muslims, who believe in a really quite fundamentalist view of what Israel should be, a majority Jewish state. And what that means practically is if you're not Jewish, and a lot of people in that state are not, you'd actually have not got equal rights. That's actually legislated within the parliament there. So right. I think many people in Palestine and elsewhere are talking now about some kind of one-state solution.
Right. And just on the experience of Jewish people, potentially in Australia, we just heard in that story before about, you know, some anti-Semitic attacks in the UK, for example. Do you think there's a risk of that happening in Australia, or are we already seeing it?
Look, there is a risk, and one of the things that's always worrying is there has been in the last years, and this was definitely worse than during the Trump era, is a real surge in anti-Semitism. And what I mean by that is people attacking Jews, attacking synagogues. Obviously, there's been in the US in the last few years some horrific, literally massacres within synagogues. And that does worry me as a Jew, but it worries me equally that there often is a conflation by many people to say that if you are critical of Israel somehow, you're anti-Semitic. Anti-Semitism is real and it's a problem and it must be fought. But ultimately, to be critical of Israel is not anti-Semitic. In fact, I would argue, the most noble thing you could do as a Jew or as a civilian. But I am worried, absolutely, about a rise in anti-Semitism. And I think people need to be really aware of the fact that that kind of thing is not acceptable ever in any way or justified.
Mm. I want to talk about the response to this conflict in Australia. And now, I don't usually refer to headlines from the Batuta Advocate, but I did find one today pretty telling. It said, "Social justice warrior tiptoes around Israel conflict." Can you unpack a bit why some, definitely not all, young Australians are hesitant to engage with this issue? I'm even seeing, you know, fewer texts than usual on the text line about this.
It's interesting, isn't it? I mean, I saw that headline. I thought it was quite apt. And what that means, I think, is that I think many people, for two reasons, stay away from this issue. One, they think, I don't know enough about it, so therefore I shouldn't comment. Okay. But the other one, I think, is more insidious. There is definitely a sensation that many people don't want to be accused of anti-Semitism simply for being critical of Israeli apartheid. And I think also there's an expression often that I use and others use called progressive except Palestine, PEP. And often we see a lot of progressives around the world, not just in Australia, who are critical of a range of issues, refugee policy, economic policy, whatever it may be. But when it comes to the question of Israel and Palestine, which we are, I would argue, deeply complicit in as Australians because we support Israel uncritically, they stay silent. And I think that's a problem. So I think that's probably what that's referring to, is my guess.
Yeah, and I suppose every conversation we have like this one on the radio, hopefully people do feel a bit more empowered to talk about it openly. On that, Anthony Lowenstein, thanks so much for coming on Triple J and sharing your insights.
Thanks so much for having me.
Hack. So, yeah, it really, really sucked that we had to move. We essentially were forced out by the mould.
On Triple J.
have you got mold at your place? Maybe it creeps up in your bathrooms or in the corners of your kitchen ceilings. Mold isn't just gross, it can really affect your health, it can make you sick. And if you're a young person who's renting, you'll know how much of a mission it can be to get your landlord to fix pretty much anything, let alone deal with something like mold. If you have trouble with mould in a rental, I want to hear from you. Give me a call on 1300 055 36. So how can mould make you unwell, and what are your rights if you've got a mould problem and a landlord who won't listen? Dee Salmon has this story.
My childhood asthma came back to the point where I was using a puffer once a day, and my eczema that I've had since childhood was the worst it's ever been.
It was literally peeling off, like your skin was peeling off.
Yeah.
It was bad.
That's Sophie and Mitch, and over the past year, they've been dealing with some pretty hectic health issues.
Had really bad gut issues. Also, I noticed a really huge spike in my anxiety and depression.
For ages, they couldn't figure out why they were feeling so shit all the time, until they spoke to a naturopath. And straight away, she knew exactly what was wrong.
She said, "Does your place have mold?" And I said, "Yes." And she goes, "Well, there's your problem."
So I actually went to their rental in Bondi, and I remember the mould. There was black everywhere. It was really, really bad.
Up through the floorboards from under the house. Our roof was slowly getting covered by mould. Yeah, I lost like 3 pairs of good shoes, 4 handbags, 2 leather jackets. It was eating everything.
Anything that we would call a flu-like symptoms, rashes, inflammation, irritable bowel syndrome.
Dr. Heike Neumeister-Kemp is a mycologist, so like a fungal scientist, she goes into houses and it's her job to get rid of the mould.
I do this about 25 years now in Australia.
Yeah, she reckons there's millions and millions of people who have got health issues from mould and probably just don't realise it.
90% of it is not visible. Most people have no idea they have slow leaks, or water damage most likely equals that you have mould.
When I first started looking into this issue, I was like, well, it's probably just the climate in Bondi, right? But no, Dr. Heike says it's not a climate issue, it's actually a structural issue. Apparently here in Australia, we don't have great heating and ventilation.
It has to do with the attitude, how we maintain and build houses. As soon as you have under 18 degrees, you have what we say a dew point condensation. So as soon as you form droplets, there is enough available moisture for the fungi to grow.
It seems like mould is a bigger problem to deal with when you're renting. Because it's so hard to find a place at the moment. Once you do, you don't really want to piss your landlords off by complaining about things, and they know that they can easily just replace you with someone else. Well, that's what happened to Sophie and Mitch.
So his suggestion was move out. So yeah, it really, really sucked that we had to move. We essentially were forced out by the mould. It's so hard to find rentals in Bondi.
In Australia, what they do is they just put an incense stick in and wax some fresh paint over it.
Yeah, it was actually really funny to hear Heike say that, because the last place I was in, the landlord literally did that. He covered all the mould that we had in the bathroom in white paint.
That is actual criminal, because you now know that there's a defect and you deliberately make people sick.
So what can you do if you're stuck in a bit of a battle with your real estate or landlord?
First thing you need to do is just put it in writing to your landlord that you have noticed mould in the property. In Victoria now, mould's considered an urgent repair. So the landlord actually has a legal duty to fix the issue.
This is Bill Maloney, a lawyer from Tenants Victoria. And every winter, he says they get heaps of calls about mould problems in rentals.
If there's a mould issue and it's caused due to the structure of the property, then it is actually the landlord's legal duty to get it fixed.
Yeah, so like Bill said earlier, in Victoria, there's been some pretty big changes. They're the only state in Australia who have changed rental laws, so mould is now considered an urgent repair. Bill says no matter what state you're in, if you've got a landlord like Sophie's and they're telling you if you don't love it, leave, well, that's just not good enough.
It's unacceptable that a landlord would say that sort of thing. If the landlord's not doing anything, then you can look to take that next step and look to enforce your rights through the various tribunals in each state and territory.
So basically he means you can take them to court. I know it sounds scary, but he said it's actually pretty easy and it can even be done over the phone.
Tenants just need to be aware of their rights and they need to look to enforce their rights.
And that's great advice, but for people like Sophie and Mitch who have finally found a mold-free apartment, they think, they just want to feel better again.
I think they need to either disclose it or there needs to be something put in place to protect young people from this. I literally want to write notes and leave them in the cupboard saying, get out. Or leave.
Hack on Triple J.
Dee Salmon reporting there. I'm Ange McCormack. You're listening to Hack on Triple J. And on the text line, Andrew from Perth, you say, I've had issues with mould, but I keep on top of it. The issue occurs in the ceiling of my bedroom because there's no insulation in the roof. Good luck convincing a landlord to spend any money on insulation. That's probably a good point. In Dee's story, we just heard about tenants taking action, but I want to get some more tips about what you can actually do in this situation if you're feeling a bit lost. Erin Turner is the head of campaigns at Choice. Erin, thanks for joining me. What's the first step you should do as a renter if you look up and spot some mould at your home?
Take a photo. Record it. Now, sometimes it's really hard to know if you've caused the mould or if it's a big, deep structural issue because, you know, you can't see into the roof, you don't know if there's a broken pipe, but keep records. The last thing you want is for this mould to fester. Chances are, like, your landlord might not deal with it, which is disappointing, but you don't want to be caught with the blame at the end of the lease.
Right,
you want to be able to say, I reported it, I recorded it, and even better, I cleaned it and it still came back.
Right, okay. And landlords and real estate agents don't have the best reputation for acting quickly with haste on anything. Some of them do, I'm sure, but a lot of them don't. We've just heard how it can be so bad for your health, though. It's important to get onto this stuff urgently, but what do you do if your landlord's being a bit lazy and not getting onto it?
Look, this is where it's really frustrating because you do have rights. You have rights for a fit and healthy home, depending on your state. But there's also something that I think every renter will have experienced. There's a real power imbalance in making a complaint when you rent. Unfortunately, across Australia, there's something called no grounds evictions. A landlord can kick you out without reason. And that means that renters are worried about raising complaints and using their rights. And it's not surprising. They're not wrong in a lot of cases.
Julia, what's your experience been?
Hey, I was in a house that had mold in 2017 in an outside of Melbourne, and I was sick for 10 weeks, but we didn't realise that it was mold because we couldn't see anything. So they must have been, like, painted over or something. And I went on a random antibiotics, they thought I had the flu. Okay. And then after 6 weeks of being sick, my doctor was like, is anyone else in your house sick? And I said, oh, yeah, my housemate's been sick for about 3 weeks now. He went, I reckon it's mold. Get it checked.
Right.
Had someone come and check the house. They checked it. They did all these different tests. And yeah, it was mold. So it was just somewhere in my room, but I couldn't see it.
Okay. And what happened? And then, did you tell your landlord or were you renting?
Yeah, I was renting. Yeah, in a share house.
And did they, compensate you or fix it or what happened?
So they didn't compensate me. Like I said, like I'd been to the doctor so many times. I was sick for like almost 3 months. Was like getting behind in uni and stuff, but they provided us with a dehumidifier for the house, and they got the house fumigated, so we had to be out of the house for like a day, and someone came and like dealt with the mold, and then we had to have the dehumidifier on basically every day, and the amount of water that was collected was incredible.
Well, that sounds hectic. I'm glad you got on top of it at the time. Erin, I was surprised that mould is only an urgent repair in Victoria. What do other states and territories need to do about this issue?
Look, it really varies. Most states and territories don't have any specific guidance about what is an urgent repair or how you can get repairs or even just what is a basic standard a home should meet. Most rental rights across Australia are really weak, and that means when you go to make that complaint, you're often facing barriers either practical because the law isn't specific enough or soft barriers. You're really aware that you might be relying on your landlord as a reference to get your next place or that you could face a rental increase or an eviction for no reason. Like, that is rightly in people's minds.
Yeah. On the text line, Joe in Queensland says, I'm a landlord that has fixed mould in the past.
Yes.
Good on you, Joe. It takes ages to fix. I don't think tenants understand how long it takes. Someone else says, our rental has mold through the bedroom. We had to fight so hard just to break our lease. We threw out shoes, clothes and more. New tenants moved in 3 days later. Erin, a common theme we're hearing here is that tenants do struggle with their rights sometimes. I know it can be really hard to speak up as a tenant because you might be worried that you'll be kicked out. Surely this imbalance of power between tenants and landlords has to change, right?
Exactly. We've been saying this. Tenants unions have been saying this for years. Ultimately, what every state and territory needs needs to do is get rid of no grounds evictions. If a landlord's going to get rid of you, they should have a good reason. And you making a complaint and using your rights shouldn't be it.
Erin, I know you've experienced this problem yourself.
Yes.
And you have some tips about how to avoid mold, clean it. Just quickly, what are some of your top tips for that?
So we actually have a whole guide on Choice on the website. It's a process, but vinegar is just my one steer.
Okay.
A lot of the commercial stuff on supermarket shelves, it uses bleach, but that loses effectiveness over time. So if you've got something on your back shelf with a bit of bleach in it, it might not work as well as just four parts vinegar, one part water.
Okay. And if that fails, is it calling in the professionals?
Yeah. it depends on, you can deal with the mold there, but if there's some deep structural issues, so if it's a leaking pipe or an issue with a leaking roof, a landlord has to fix that in order to stop the mold permanently.
Okay. Vinegar, take a photo, tell your landlord. I think that's covers it. The biggest basis. Erin Turner, thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you.
Hack. I felt so small and I felt a real sense of shame about myself and who I was and who I loved.
On Triple J.
Over the past few years, a lot has been done to improve the rights of LGBTQI Australians. Marriage equality is one of them. There's also more visibility of gender-diverse Australians in our media. Even last week, Instagram started encouraging users to put pronouns in their bios. But it'd be pretty naive to think that there really is full equality for the LGBTQI community in Australia. As an example, research from Beyond Blue says 75% of young LGBTQI Australians experience bullying for who they are, and they're five times more likely to attempt suicide compared to the general population. Today is Ida Hobbit, that stands for International Day Against Homophobia, Biphobia, intersexism and transphobia. If you've experienced this, I want to hear from you. How did it feel and how have you dealt with it? Text in on 0439 757555. Adrian Murdoch is from Minus 18. They're a youth organisation advocating for young, same-sex attracted and gender diverse people. Adrian, the awareness around today is really great, but in an ideal world, we wouldn't actually need a day like this. Everyone should feel safe no matter who they are. Why do you think we have such a long way to go?
Hey, Ange. Yeah, I think, you know, for the LGBTQIA plus community, it's twofold. A day like today helps us to continue to do the work that we need, especially for members of the LGBTQIA plus community who might be intersectional. So that's young people or people from the community who might also be a person of colour or culturally or linguistically diverse, or, you know, someone who's First Nations, who not only deal with the societal pressures around being LGBTQIA plus, but, you know, that identity as well. So I think there's still a long way for us to elevate those voices that have a much different marginalized experience to what a lot of people are experienced to. But also a day like today helps us to celebrate as well.
Yeah, and a big message from Ida Hobbit is to be visible today and every day, you know, by wearing rainbow, putting pronouns in your Insta bio. To me, they seem like really quite small actions. Do they actually help?
Absolutely. I think it's a really exciting way. I think we've really come a long way, especially in a digital existence after COVID-19, to, you know, do things in a way of raising the rainbow flag at a school, which is, you know, such a poignant moment for a young person who's school age, or, you know, wearing a rainbow pin to, you know, your workplace or a local community. We've even partnered with Snapchat to make pride lenses to make visibility and representation that much more accessible and youth accessible as well, because, you know, they're living on their phones. And if we can have these pride lenses as a way that people can show allyship and show acceptance, you know, that can mean so much to another young person who sees that.
Yeah, absolutely. High school can be a really tough place at the best of times. I mean, if you're different, you can pretty easily become a target, let alone if you're, you know, at a religious school where there might not be as much acceptance or visibility. What do you think needs to be done in our schools to make them a more welcoming place?
I think visibility is a big part of it, in the sense of, you know, showing acceptance. My own personal experience of high school, I never had the visibility of a rainbow flag, let alone, you know, the trans flag in creating an awareness and an acceptance that, you know, you're supported and you're celebrated in this space. And I think, you know, that small gesture just helps to kind of switch the narrative from it being something that's taboo to being something that, you know, we want to talk about and we want to support you. And I think, you know, when we compare it to some schools that really outwardly, you know, move around that and you know, look to sort of push that out of the, be it the curriculum or be it out of the general awareness. You know, young people are still identifying that way and, you know, want to celebrate their friends that way. And so I think we're going to see a resistance to that increasingly. And I think we're seeing that even on like a level in the policy that we see on a national level and the feedback that it gets.
Yeah.
But people just don't want to see that.
Absolutely. Adrian, I wish we could talk longer about this, but that is all we've got time for. Adrian Murdoch from Minus 18, thanks so much for joining me.
My pleasure. Happy Idle Hobbit.
Hack on Triple J.
Just for you podcasters, we've got a few more texts that came through. Greg in Sydney said mold is always a structural problem. Someone else says, in my last rental, a mushroom sprouted from the tiles due to a leaky pipe in the wall. I was really unwell and diagnosed with mold illness / toxicity. The landlord refused to fix it properly. Mold is extremely hard to get rid of. Thanks so much for listening. I'll catch you tomorrow on the Hack Podcast.